Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, Israeli forces withdraw from southern Gaza and ceasefire talks resume in Cairo, 6 months after Hamas's October 7th attack.
Millions of people across the United States witness a rare total solar eclipse. We'll bring you a view from along the path of totality.
And the push to reform the Insurrection Act and curb a president's power to deploy the U.S. military on American soil.
It's just a blank check for any president, and so it's an opportunity for abuse for any president.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today said he set a date for the invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza, where 1.4 million people have sought shelter.
That comes as hostage and ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas again appear to be at an impasse tonight as senior leaders meet in Cairo. Meanwhile, some Gazans return to another southern Gaza city, the scene of brutal fighting and destruction. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
They returned by the thousands, Gazans hoping to find their homes. But Khan Yunis is unrecognizable. It is destroyed, full of debris, and his former residents devastated. Houses are flattened like pancakes. Apartment blocks are gutted into carcasses. This was once home to 500,000 people. Today, it has been left to the scavengers, like Hanan. She tries to salvage anything from the ruins of her house. There is no construction crew, only a stray cat who, like her, has lost everyone and everything.
No words can describe my pain. Our memories, our dreams, our childhood, and our family all are gone. I didn't find anything to take out from the rubble. We didn't take anything when we fled.
Around every turn, there are more ruined roads, more details of deprivation. Sitting in the shadow of his former home and his former life, Ishmael told us today he'd lived here for 4 decades.
My feelings? My life is ruined. My life is destroyed and ruined. Everything from the past 40 years is gone. What can we say? Only God is sufficient.
But Khan Yunis is also the home to Hamas leaders, and Hamas videos show gunmen fighting Israeli troops from the ruins of homes. This weekend, Khan Yunis' Israeli troops recover the body of hostage Elad Katzir, kidnapped on October the 7th. And just today, an Israeli strike destroyed a Hamas rocket that misfired. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the withdrawal from Khan Yunis followed the dismantling of Hamas's military units.
Our forces are going to prepare for their follow-up missions. We will see such missions in the Rafah area.
Rafah's home to some 1.4 million displaced Gazans, and Israel has told U.S. officials it's preparing tents to move Gazans north from Rafah to al-Mawasi and areas north of Khan Yunis. But U.S. officials say Israel has not yet presented a full evacuation plan, even though today Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said a Rafah operation was on the calendar.
Victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Today, State Department spokesman Matt Miller reiterated that the U.S. opposes a major ground invasion into Rafah, regardless of Israeli evacuation plans.
We think it would, number one, harm all the more than 1.4 million Palestinians. It would hinder the delivery of humanitarian assistance. So we have made clear that we don't want to see that full-scale invasion in any event.
In the last few days, Israel has opened additional crossings, and today more than 415 trucks entered Gaza, the largest number since the war began. But the UN and US are pushing for the number to increase to pre-war levels above 500.
It is not just important that they take initial steps to facilitate the increase of humanitarian assistance, but that increased flow of humanitarian assistance be sustained over time.
Increased humanitarian assistance is one of Hamas's demands on hostage negotiations. Regional officials tell me that CIA Director Bill Burns, Qatar's prime minister, and Israeli and Egyptian spy chiefs have created a new proposal that's gone to Hamas in which Israel has softened its resistance to a Hamas request to let Gazans return to northern Gaza, but not by enough to expect an imminent breakthrough. What U.S. officials do fear is imminent, an attack by Iran, in response to an Israeli strike in Damascus that killed senior Iranian commanders.
And overnight, Israel launched a series of airstrikes into southern Lebanon, killing Ali Ahmed Hussein, one of Hezbollah's most senior commanders. In Beirut today, Hezbollah supporters mourned his death. U.S. officials fear Hezbollah or Iran itself could attack Israeli assets in the region or in Israel, a warning repeated by Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah today.
Be certain, be sure, that the Iranian response to the targeting of the consulate in Damascus is definitely coming against Israel.
Today, Iran accused the U.S. of approving Israel's Damascus strike. U.S. officials say they assured Iran in private messages that they did not know ahead of time. The U.S. has also warned Iran it would be held responsible if Iran or its proxies strike U.S. bases. Already, those bases are on high alert. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
In the day's other headlines, an appeals judge in New York denied former President Trump's 11th-hour bid to delay his hush money criminal trial. He's accused of falsifying records to hide payments to an adult film actress. But his lawyers asked to move the proceedings out of Manhattan, forcing a postponement. For now, pending further appeals, the trial is set to start on April 15th. The National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, representing small colleges, effectively banned transgender athletes from women's sports today. It's believed to be the first college sports organization to take that step. A group statement said, quote, "Each NAIA sport includes some combination of strength, speed, and stamina, providing competitive advantages for male student athletes." The Vatican has reaffirmed its opposition to gender-affirming surgery and surrogate parenting. A 20-page document released today characterizes both as threats to human dignity. At a news conference, a top cardinal said it reinforces a stance of welcoming transgender people in the church, but not so-called gender ideologies.
We believe that these ideologies, instead of helping to recognize dignity, impoverish a humanistic vision where man and woman are the most beautiful combination in the greatest difference that humanity contains.
A few months ago, another Vatican document approved blessings for same-sex couples and triggered a backlash from some conservative bishops. In Mozambique, local reports say the death toll has reached at least 98 in a ferry boat sinking. Officials say the crowded makeshift vessel capsized on Sunday. Seven more bodies were found today as the search continued, with an unknown number still missing and 11 others hospitalized. Some on board were fleeing a cholera outbreak. Russia and Ukraine blamed each other again today for drone strikes on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. UN inspectors have confirmed Sunday's attacks, but said the nuclear safety system was undamaged. Russia released video of drone debris at the plant, which its forces control, and the Kremlin accused Ukraine of attacking. Kyiv, in turn, said the Russians orchestrated the whole thing. Floodwaters are still rising in Russia's southern Ural region after heavy flooding. The worst of it is in the Orenburg region near the Kazakhstan border. It's being caused by rising water levels in the Ural River. As of today, officials estimate roughly 10,000 homes have been flooded. Most are near the site of where a dam burst on Friday.
People are being evacuated using watercraft, inflatable boats, and transporters that can accommodate up to 50 people. The evacuation is being carried out gradually, street by street, and people are also being notified through loudspeakers.
Residents there staged a rare protest against the government today, demanding compensation for their flood losses. Here at home, the FAA is investigating a new incident involving a Boeing 737 airliner. The Southwest Airlines jet was grounded Sunday morning after an engine cover fell off during takeoff from Denver. The plane was a Boeing 737-800 series, not the 737 MAX that's been under scrutiny. The Biden administration will invest up to $6.6 billion toward the goal of more microchip production in the U.S. Today's announcement goes to help a Taiwanese company expand its Arizona facilities. The chips are used in everything from cars and smartphones to fighter jets. And on Wall Street, stocks barely budged to start the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 11 points to close at 38,892. The NASDAQ rose 5 points. The S&P 500 slipped 2. And in college basketball, Purdue and the University of Connecticut, UConn, are facing off tonight for the men's national title. And unbeaten South Carolina claimed the women's championship on Sunday, beating Iowa and Caitlin Clark 87-75. The Gamecocks have won two titles in the last three seasons. Still to come on the NewsHour, Minnesota becomes the latest front line in the fight for fair pay for rideshare drivers. President Biden announces his new plan to forgive student loan debt. And Leanne Caldwell and Stephen Fowler break down the political headlines.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Millions of Americans took a break today to step outside and check out the rare total eclipse that cut across the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Where skies were clear, people could witness the moon blocking out the sun almost entirely today, plunging some cities and towns into darkness for several minutes. In many other places, it was a chance to look at a partial eclipse, with the right glasses, of course. Our science correspondent Miles O'Brien spent his day in Dallas.
It was a Texas-sized eclipse viewing party. Despite a gray forecast, thousands came to the Cotton Bowl in Dallas to witness the sun, moon, and earth perform a cosmic line dance. The gawkers were joined by some astronomical experts, docents for a day this crowd will long remember. Solar physicist Carrie Black is the National Science Foundation program officer for the National Solar Observatory.
What I'm really hoping the kids and adults take away alike is the excitement of the experience.
Space physicist Joe Westlake is head of heliophysics for NASA.
I feel like these kinds of things show you that the celestial bodies are real, that the moon is a thing that changes, that has differences, that the sun is something that is active, that's happening. And I feel like our connection as humans to that celestial event is amazing.
More than 30 million Americans live beneath the path of the total eclipse. Millions more migrated to the diagonal swath, the roads to get there snarled by heavy traffic. Some enthusiasts were out before dawn at the crest of Niagara Falls, vying for a front row seat.
This is the closest eclipse to where we live until 2079. So if we're even alive by then, so this is truly a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
I think it's almost part of human nature to sort of see these things and become curious about the unknown.
For much of the day, spectators waited anxiously on the misty overlooks for clouds to clear. But others, 309 to be exact, came dressed to brighten up the occasion. The city broke the Guinness World Record today for the most people dressed as the main attraction, the sun. And as afternoon finally rolled around, the cloudy skies parted just in time for the eclipse to usher in some daytime stargazing. Watch parties drew in massive crowds to the Indy 500 racetrack, to Idabel, Oklahoma, where viewers basked in the sun with certified and improvised eyewear. The sunlight disappeared, and kids jumped for joy. And even in the nation's capital, hundreds of miles away from the moon's shadow, but close enough to catch a glimpse of it skirting over 87% of the sun. A solar eclipse occurs thanks to a sublime coincidence. Our moon is 400 times smaller than our sun, but also 400 times closer. So when it passes between, voila, a spectacular optical illusion. The three bodies line up just right between 2 and 5 times a year. It doesn't happen every month because the moon's orbit is tilted 5 degrees relative to Earth. A total solar eclipse occurs on any given spot on the planet once every 375 years.
This is a unique event, and it spurs all sorts of lines of inquiry in the youth. And I hope that they take that home, they ask their own questions, they find their own results.
The Cotton Bowl sits right in the so-called path of totality, where the clouds parted and the moon completely covered the sun for about 4 minutes. They geared up under watchful eyes, protecting the lenses they brought and the ones they were born with. What would happen in space was an ironclad certainty, but the Earth's atmosphere served up a wild card of unpredictability. Here in Dallas, the morning overcast petered out, and a patch of blue broke through just as the day turned to night and back again in 4 minutes' time. A lucky turn for these young people who enjoyed the coolest science class ever.
What'd you learn the most?
I learned that the world, like things, like nature and things, can be tied in into learning.
I got to see the solar eclipse, and it's not gonna happen for another 100 years.
Why do you think eclipses are so exciting, especially to young people?
Because it's something we don't see every day. We don't get to see it every day. It's something, you know, that's rare. So of course it's exciting when we get to see it. And so I don't think any of them saw it in 2017. So they're really excited to be able to see it.
On this eclipse day, the country did seem upside down. Normally sunny Texas was cloudy, while in the Northeast, April showers took a break. The clouds were pushed aside by high pressure. And so the big light show got better as it moved across the lower 48. For NASA, clouds were not a worry. As it did during the last American eclipse in 2017, the agency launched a pair of high-flying research platforms, 50,000-foot jet sorties to the edge of our atmosphere to learn more about the edge of the sun's atmosphere. It's called the corona, or crown. Hotter than the sun, yet also a million times dimmer, the corona is usually cloaked in brightness. It sends a steady stream of particles toward Earth, causing beautiful auroras, but they also can interfere with radio communications, GPS signals, and satellite operations. Scientists also hope to learn more about how the sun affects the Earth's atmosphere. The space agency launched 3 sounding rockets from Wallops Island, Virginia, before, during, and after the eclipse to measure how the upper atmosphere changes when sunlight momentarily dims during the 90% eclipse there. Wherever people saw the eclipse, there was an atmosphere of excitement. For my money, this was better than a championship-winning touchdown in overtime here at the Cotton Bowl. But I'm not from Texas.
Miles O'Brien. You know, Miles, there was a lot of talk about clouds or cloud cover potentially obstructing some of the view in the big show, even where you are. But how did it actually turn out? Tell us about what you saw.
All morning long, here we were with thousands of young people, all enjoying an awesome field trip. And it was kind of grim. And we were thinking, well, you know, at least we have the excitement of them being here and it'll get dark. And then we had a patch and it was just at the right place and at the right time. And it was just a thrill. And I think the fact that we didn't know if we were going to see it kind of enhanced the whole enjoyment of it. It was fabulous.
So depending on where people work, we know people traveled all over the country to see this. Who do you think had the best view today?
The weather got better as it went to the northeast today, and we did have some touch-and-go clouds. But I've seen an eclipse back in 2017 on perfectly clear day. Part of what I realized today is the company you keep as you watch it. And being here in this stadium, filled with young people who were so thrilled to see it and who will have an experience they will remember the rest of their lives, that took it over the top for me. So I would say I win.
Well, Miles, you've also said, of course, we're not expecting another eclipse in North America for another 20 years. But, of course, these happen all around the globe with some kind of regularity. So when's the next one coming up? And do you think people will travel for that as well?
The next total eclipse will occur in August of 2026. It'll start in Greenland, go to Iceland, Spain, Portugal, Russia. I am going to propose to you right now, Amna, and maybe we should do it right now. Let's book a trip to watch that eclipse in Iceland.
Let's do it.
I think it will be amazing.
I'm in.
Fire and ice.
A trip with Miles O'Brien to watch a total
right?
eclipse.
Let's do it.
Absolutely. Miles O'Brien joining us from Dallas, Texas, in the path of totality. Miles, always great to see you. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Amna.
A bipartisan group of former senior government officials is urging lawmakers on Capitol Hill to rein in a president's ability to deploy the U.S. military within the country. Called the Insurrection Act, the centuries-old provision allows any president to use emergency powers to send U.S. troops into American cities. One of the leaders of these proposed reforms is Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School. and former Assistant Attorney General in the George W. Bush administration. He joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And although these proposed reforms would apply to any future president, it was former President Donald Trump who considered invoking the Insurrection Act to put down protests after the murder of George Floyd, and who has since vowed to send U.S. troops into Democratic cities if he is reelected. We should note, though, that you co-wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times where you say, "This focus on Mr. Trump is understandable but inadequate in capturing the compelling case for reform." In what ways?
The Insurrection Act, as it's currently written, is a blank check for any president to bring the military into the domestic realm. It has extremely vague triggers for its use. It has no time limit on its use. It's just a blank check for any president, and so it's an opportunity for abuse for any president. And there have been reform proposals for the Insurrection Act going back decades. So it's the time to do it is now, and the reason to do it is that no president should have this authority.
So what are some of the proposed changes to this, as you say, ill-defined Insurrection Act?
There are essentially two core changes. The first is that the statute has very antiquated language and very vague triggers for when the president can invoke it to bring the military into the domestic realm. It talks about assemblages and combinations, and it's the mere possibility of domestic violence of any sort is enough under the statute. So our group proposed tightening up, narrowing the circumstances in which the president can use it. The second, and in many ways the most important reform, is to bring Congress back into the use of the statute. The president derives his authority to invoke the statute only because Congress gave it to him in the Insurrection Act. And we think that the president should have to consult with Congress, should have to make findings to Congress about why he's using the act, and most importantly, that the president be limited, time limited, in his use of the act. So the authority to invoke the act to bring the military into the domestic realm should be limited. We propose no more than 30 days.
There will be those who question the wisdom of placing limits on presidential power. There will be people who think that these reforms benefit one party over the other, to which you say what?
Well, as I said, they don't benefit one party over the other. This statute can be invoked by any president. There was discussion. President Biden was urged by members of his party to federalize the National Guard down in Texas, given the standoff with the governor of Texas over the border. And any president can use this authority. I should add that there's a need for presidents to have this authority. It's an important authority for extreme cases. But any president can use it, and any president can abuse it.
How would you get these changes through this Congress?
Well, we hope to convince members of Congress that this is a reform that needs to be done. There's actually a consensus in Congress right now, a longstanding several-year consensus, represented in several bills for broader emergency powers reform. The president has an array of emergency powers that he can invoke endlessly, and there's actually bipartisan support to rein those powers in. There are bills moving through the Congress on that. And we think that the argument for this statute is very similar and should be attractive to both sides.
In just the past week, we've seen the Biden administration announce a new rule making it harder to fire federal workers in an effort to prevent Donald Trump from gutting the federal workforce if he's reelected. We've seen changes to the Electoral Count Act to prevent another January 6th. There's now this proposal to change the Insurrection Act. In your view, is Washington taking seriously enough and moving quickly enough to shore up the weaknesses in our laws and in our system that might be open to exploitation and abuse?
We've learned since Watergate that that the norms and laws that were put in place in Watergate, their effectiveness has diminished. They were diminishing before President Trump came into office, and their weaknesses were apparent when President Trump was in office. And these weaknesses were well known going back a long time, and Congress has actually done very little to address these problems. The Electoral Count Reform Act that you mentioned to improve the process in the period in December and January in which the president is selected by in the Electoral College, that was a very important reform. But beyond that, Congress really hasn't done much, and there's a whole array of things it should be doing, but the Insurrection Act should be at the top of the list.
That is Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School, former Assistant Attorney General in the George W. Bush administration. Thanks so much for your time and for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
The latest front line in the battle over fair pay for rideshare drivers is in Minneapolis. Uber and Lyft have threatened to leave the city over a new ordinance that sets minimum wages for drivers. As special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports, it's leading to bigger questions about the state of the gig economy.
Lifelong Minneapolis resident Matthew McGlory started driving for Uber and Lyft over 7 years ago. He loves the flexibility, the chance to meet new people, and for a while, he felt like drivers and the companies were true partners. But in the past few years, McGlory says, drivers have seen a smaller cut of fares.
Is it fair that Lyft or Uber will charge a passenger $67 and give the driver $23? We're not asking for anything more than we think we deserve or anything more than we think is fair.
That's why McGlory supported a recent Minneapolis City Council ordinance that sets minimum pay for rideshare drivers. It requires the companies to pay drivers at least $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute during rides.
This fight is really simple. It's about giving workers a minimum wage.
These are static facts.
Council member Robin Wansley helped write the policy.
We hold the standard that workers should earn livable wages. We should not make exemptions for rideshare drivers because they're part of the gig economy. This is the time to reevaluate our dependence on two corporate giants that have based their entire economic model on paying their drivers sub-minimum wages.
Immediately after the ordinance passed, both Uber and Lyft said they would stop operating in Minneapolis on May 1st, the day the increases take effect. Uber spokesman Josh Gold.
What we saw in other markets is if you raise rates too high, you may be making more for each individual trip. Because demand's going to go down, you'll actually be making less on an hourly basis.
Are you really going to leave on May 1st if this doesn't change?
Yes.
Gold pointed to the company's decision to leave Austin, Texas in 2016 after that city passed a driver fingerprinting requirement. It only returned when the state passed a law preempting the city. But Uber and Lyft have backed down from threats to leave elsewhere.
I really hope we can continue to work with drivers and policymakers in Minneapolis to continue to stay. But, you know, if it doesn't make sense to operate a business, we won't operate a business.
The day after Minneapolis passed its ordinance, the state released a study of the rideshare industry. It found Minnesota drivers are mostly black male immigrants, many living in low-income households. The study also found that drivers would make the equivalent of minimum wage in Minneapolis plus car expenses if they were paid 89 cents per mile and 49 cents per minute. Those rates are lower than the city ordinance, but driver pay would still increase about 10%. And at those levels, Uber and Lyft say they could stay in the market. On a recent afternoon near Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, drivers waiting for customers expressed mixed feelings.
In order to keep the job, you need to keep the companies in the city. We need something they're happy and we're happy between the study and the city.
I don't think the rates that Minneapolis is giving worth Uber leaving. No, I don't think so. If they can work something out, fine, but I don't think it's worth Uber leaving.
95% of all Minnesota rideshare trips begin in the Twin Cities. So a departure from the metropolitan Minneapolis-St. Paul area would effectively end the app's presence in the state. And that's prompted concern among policymakers on both sides of the aisle.
Senator Dornick is...
Lawmakers are trying to finalize legislation before May 1st that would both satisfy drivers and keep the companies operating here. Meanwhile, the Minneapolis City Council has said it may reconsider its ordinance as soon as this week. But no matter what happens, the situation in Minnesota is being watched closely, says Cornell University's Andrew Wolf.
What Uber and Lyft are doing in Minneapolis is not new. There are pushes in other cities, and I think Minneapolis is kind of a perfect place for them to make a stink. because it is a bigger city where this would have an impact, but it's not such a big city that it would really, you know, impact their bottom line. They're trying to make a big show out of Minneapolis in order to try to stop these other efforts from moving forward.
If Uber and Lyft do leave, other rideshare companies have vowed to fill the gap. But until then, drivers like Matthew McGlory are weighing their options. He's starting a job with a property management company this week.
Drivers aren't leaving. The cars that we drive aren't going anywhere, right? They're saying they want to leave. Is that really done in the spirit of true partnership?
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in the Twin Cities.
Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
President Biden today announced new plans to cancel student debt for millions of borrowers. Lisa Desjardins is here with more. So, Lisa, this is President Biden's broadest attempt at student loan debt forgiveness since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down his previous effort more than a year ago. Is that right?
That's right, Jeff. The administration did not give final details of their plan today, but they did outline executive actions that they're teeing up. Those would eliminate at least $20,000 in accrued interest for those who owe more than their original loan, offer more for those with lower incomes, cancel remaining debt for anyone who has spent 20 or 25 years, depending on the loan, repaying their loans, and void loans from college programs that were proven to be deceptive. Biden spoke about the move today.
By freeing millions of Americans from this crushing debt of student debt, it means they can finally get on with their lives instead of their lives being put on hold.
Danielle Douglas Gabriel covers the economics of higher education for The Washington Post and joins me now. Danielle, the White House says some 23 million Americans could be affected by this and a financial boost for them. Help us understand, who exactly does the White House think this helps?
Sure. So the vast majority of federal student loan borrowers could see some relief under this plan. And it's important to note there are many facets to the plan, five categories of borrowers in total. But perhaps the largest category that could deliver relief is the one that eliminates up to $20,000 in student loan interest from a borrower's balance. This is pretty common that borrowers may have borrowed, say, $20,000, but because of the way interest accrues on student loans, could owe twice as much over the lifetime of their loan. So this proposal would really help those folks. And the White House is saying about 25 million people will benefit from that part, but 23 million of that 25 could get their interest completely eliminated under this plan.
As you indicate, this is a complex proposal, and in part that's because of the Supreme Court's previous decisions, the Biden administration trying to put something together that they think can remain legally intact. But help us understand, with all that complexity, when could this actually go into place?
So what's interesting here is that most of us have been watching this law, and keep in mind that the regulation started to be crafted right after the Supreme Court struck down Biden's last attempt at this large-scale debt relief. But we thought, many of us, that the full regulation wouldn't be implemented until next summer. But the Biden administration has zeroed in on a couple of elements that they could do earlier. Most importantly, the interest reduction piece, which the administration says they could likely push out this fall ahead of the election.
We talked about the benefits to many millions of Americans, but let's also talk about the costs. They too could be substantial. Now, we know that the Biden administration has boasted that it canceled about $146 billion in loans. That's from previous programs that they implemented. Now, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, when you add in the pauses in debt relief and other Biden programs that they've put in place, it's more like $600 billion by their estimate that has been spent so far in student debt relief. And we don't know how much this new program will cost. Some, like Louisiana Republican Bill Cassidy, have repeatedly argued that this is a wealth transfer from those who have college degrees to those who have college degrees.
Where is the forgiveness for the guy who didn't go to college but is working to pay off the loan on the truck he takes to work? What about the woman who paid off her student loans but either bought a less expensive home but is now struggling to afford the mortgage that she has? Is the administration providing them relief? No, nada. Of course not.
Danielle, how's the administration respond to that idea that this wildly runs up the national debt to just give a temporary boost to a very select group of Americans?
You know, the administration has said in the past that the economic benefit of forgiving debt could be tenfold, right? People are freed up from having to make those payments. They're more likely to return money to the economy in the forms of purchasing homes, purchasing cars, spending more in general. I mean, certainly we did see some boost during the 3.5-year pause of federal student loans in terms of home purchases before interest rates really started to skyrocket. And perhaps that certainly could be the case if we were to see broader debt relief. But yes, the cost of these programs has been up for debate, as well as the utility, because it's not beneficial to all American taxpayers. But I think it's important to note that the vast majority of people who have student loan debt have debt and no degrees. There are about 40% of people, actually. And so these are people who started but didn't finish, and they are dealing with this debt, most of whom are struggling with it and see no way out. So I think that's really what the president and his administration is trying to get at, trying to help those people who didn't really get to see the benefit of their education.
This, of course, was part of a 2020 Biden election promise, but we are yet again in a presidential election year. And as you said, a big chunk of this they hope to implement before the election. Can you talk about the politics at play here for the voters that the Biden administration might be concerned about?
I mean, it's certainly not surprising that the administration is touting all of the president's accomplishments on student debt, cleaning up a lot of programs, existing forgiveness programs that weren't operating well, and helping to deliver that $146 billion that you mentioned earlier. And it's certainly not surprising that they are touting this particular plan. You know, many of us who cover this were hoping to see the final rule issued this week. The Department of Education said it's coming in the coming months, we will see something. And of course, there will be public comment on that. But, you know, I suspect, and I'm not a politics reporter, but I do suspect that as we near the election, you will see this administration continuing to highlight and uplift the work that they've done to help borrowers, particularly young borrowers who are an important part of the coalition.
Now, let's talk about the future of this in the courts. As soon as this rule comes out, do you think there could be an injunction against it filed immediately? Do you think that this is clearly on strong legal grounds? What's going to happen?
I mean, certainly it's on stronger legal grounds from what experts are telling me than the previous rule, because it's backed by a different authority, the Higher Education Act, which governs pretty much all of higher ed in terms of financial aid and all of those things, is the anchor for this. Whereas the other rule was based on a 9/11 kind of emergency power rule that, you know, the Supreme Court didn't really think met the smell test. So in this instance, I think it will be a little harder to see an immediate injunction because this went through a negotiated rulemaking process. The rule is going to come online next July, regardless of who's in office. There will likely be challenges. And it certainly, if the Trump administration were to win, they could choose not to enforce the rule. They could also choose to try to rescind the rule. So that is also a possibility to think about.
Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Congress returns from recess this week with a packed agenda and a House Speaker trying to hold together his fragile majority. Meanwhile, the presidential candidates are sharing new messages and some new policies to try to reach key voting blocks ahead of November. For more on that, let's turn now to Politics Monday. Today, with Leanne Caldwell of The Washington Post and Stephen Fowler of NPR. Amy Walter and Tamara Keith are away.
We're glad both of you are here. Thank you so much for joining us and welcome. So let's start with Congress, Leanne. Lawmakers, one of their top priorities back now that they're back in Washington this week is to pass that critical aid for Ukraine that they say they desperately need in their fight against Russia. The holdup here is in the House. It's among House Republicans. Speaker Mike Johnson has a razor-thin majority. Is Ukraine aid his priority to pass, and will he get it done?
So Speaker Johnson says that he's going to take it up. In what form, we don't know. It's probably not going to be this week, probably next week. But the thing is we don't know exactly what Speaker Johnson is going to do on Ukraine. He is discussing with the White House, trying to negotiate to try to create a bill that is more palatable to his conservative Republican conference. But the White House is insistent that the Senate already passed a bill, bipartisan, and with 70 votes, and that that is the path forward, because the politics are becoming much more tricky as every day passes, not just on the issue of Ukraine from the right, but now on the issue of Israel, which is attached to this bill from some members on the left.
Stephen, one of the plans we've heard, and we don't have a plan, as Leanne says, is he could separate aid for Israel from aid from Ukraine. That would allow Republicans who want to back aid for Israel to vote for that and not have to vote for aid for Ukraine. But it means that they would rely on Democrats to pass Ukraine aid. And that puts Speaker Johnson in a very tricky position. He could lose his speakership, or at least be threatened to be removed from his speakership for that. How do you look at this? Is he going to lose his job on this?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has a town hall tonight where she's saying that the majority is unhappy with the way things are run, and she's threatened his job over the issue of Ukraine and Israel and really how he's handled himself so far. And so this is a fractious majority, and this is a majority that individual lawmakers are holding more sway over the issues, but it's not about the issues themselves. And so what I'm looking at it is this, what's going to happen with Ukraine aid and Israel aid isn't necessarily about the specific aid to those countries themselves, but more about what this narrow, narrow Republican majority is trying to push itself moving forward and what direction it's trying to go.
What is that about then, Lee? I mean, we have to remember there was a time there was broad bipartisan support for Ukraine to give them whatever they needed in their fight to defend themselves against Russia. How did this become so political?
It sure did become political. Part of it is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been a voice that has been more skeptical of sending foreign aid to other countries. That is a part of it. But then you have the chair of the Intelligence Committee in the House just yesterday, Mike Turner, a Republican, who said that he believes that Russian propaganda has infested some members of the conversations among members of his party, that Vladimir Putin has been effective at pushing those messages that some in the Republican Party and Republican media have adopted. And so this is becoming a much more tenuous issue, especially as billions and billions of dollars are being requested to send overseas.
How do you look at it, Stephen?
Well, I mean, this is a thing where many voters that support Donald Trump resonate. Donald Trump's message of focusing more on domestic issues are resonating. You see immigration as a top issue both in Congress and on the campaign trail. And here you have these two high-profile international conflicts and billions of American spending. And the conversation has shifted more towards, if we're spending the billions of dollars there, why aren't we spending it here? And so with domestic issues in play and with domestic issues at the forefront for a lot of voters, I think that is a more effective cudgel against looking at it instead of thinking about, you know, obligations to our allies.
And among those domestic issues, we know that abortion access and abortion rights continues to be a chief issue for Democrats in particular. Just this morning, we saw former President Trump release a video articulating what he says is now his position when it comes to abortion access, saying he believes it should be a state-by-state decision. Here's more of his message.
Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people.
Leanne, we also just heard, as Lisa reported, President Biden announcing more student loan forgiveness in Wisconsin. Why these messages from both these candidates right now?
Yeah, it's a great question and great to compare the two messages to. You have abortion, which is an issue that Republicans have been struggling with. We saw this in the 2022 elections and some of the 2023 elections. And Republicans have decided that taking a specific position on a specific ban a number of weeks is not politically palatable. That's why Donald Trump evaded the issue and didn't really come out with a new position. And then you have President Biden talking about student loans, which is an issue that is really important to young people, people of color as well who are disproportionately impacted by student loan debt. And these are the areas where President Biden is suffering among the Democratic base, according to recent polling.
Well, to take a closer look at some of those numbers, you made that transition for me perfectly, Leanne. We do have in some of the latest polls capturing this moment in time, we see that decline in support among young Americans for Mr. Biden. This is in the 2020 election. We saw him then besting Mr. Trump by over 17 points there with voters under 45. Turn now to what our latest PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll shows. We saw Biden trailing Trump by about 1 point in that same group. Stephen, when you look at that, how does President Biden get those voters back?
Well, I think by doing things that were campaign promises, like we've seen today with the student loan debt. And I think it's also important to realize that both campaigns are relying on their base of voters coming home. They may not be happy with them now, but once it becomes clear that it's a binary choice between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, most of those people are going home. So you also have to look at this through the lens of about 100,000 or so people spread among seven swing states that were very narrowly decided, usually college-educated, white, suburbanites, and how they view these plans and things. And so I think that's why you're seeing this now, both with abortion and student loans, is it's not necessarily for those people, but they're sure paying attention.
Well, other things we're paying attention to. The fundraising numbers, I want to get quickly both of your takes on it as well. We now have March fundraising numbers from both campaigns. You see Team Biden outpacing Team Trump, $90 million to $65.5 million. And when you look at the overall cash on hand for the campaigns, again, you see Mr. Biden's campaign outpacing Mr. Trump's. Leanne, how do you look at that? What does that tell us about right now?
A couple things. Well, obviously, it tells us Trump is behind in the money race, and the money race in the presidential actually matters. And each candidate is going to have to raise about $1 billion or $1 billion race to get elected, usually. But it tells me that Trump is lacking money in places where it will perhaps matter, including the ground game. Money is what it takes to have an effective get out the vote effort in all of these states to reach. These voters. Also, Trump has been distracted. He hasn't spent as much time fundraising because he has a large number of court cases that he is having to tend to. And he had a big fundraiser this weekend where he raised $50 million to try to get him back on track. But he has a lot of things going on, and part of some of that money is going to pay his legal bills, too.
We should also say we can't verify some of the claims that they make about fundraising so far.
Yes.
We'll be able to later when the FEC filings come out. But, Stephen, what's your take?
I mean, I think it's money spent and money raised on two candidates that have already been president before that are very well known. And so, again, it goes back to those swing states and those persuadable voters that we're just going to see a barrage of money come into play here. And I think the difference is going to come to who has the most money, like Leanne said, of being able to turn out that particular vote.
Stephen Fowler of NPR, Leanne Caldwell of The Washington Post. Great to have you both here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Narciso Martinez is an artist whose work celebrates the vital and often invisible labor of farm workers. Martinez's work is informed by his own experiences as a farm worker, spending summers picking produce in Washington State to support himself while studying at Cal State Long Beach. Tonight, he gives his brief but spectacular take on painting the people who feed America.
Anywhere in the world, farm workers are always at the bottom of the social strata. In my art, I just hope to shine a light to these people. They are not machines, they are human beings with goals and dreams. I grew up in a small town on the outskirts of Oaxaca City called Santa Cruz Papalutla. It was a poor community. Going to school was difficult. The roads weren't paved. I came to the United States when I was 20 years old. My first memories in the United States had to do with education. I wanted to understand the culture. I wanted to know what the movies were about. And so my brother took me to Hollywood High within the first week of arrival. And that's where I enrolled to learn English. And I got my high school degree in 2006. By that time, I was already 29, and I took an art history class, and that's when I fell in love with art. And so that's how I ended up in art school. I started working in the fields every summer to help pay for tuition. I was in academia, and I was learning all these fancy words, and at the same time, I was in the fields, listening to corridos and speaking slang to my coworkers. I started meeting other farm workers, and we started sharing stories. And I realized that it wasn't fair the way they were being treated. Most of these people, including myself, had a very difficult time growing up. I feel like when we come to a country where there is a bed for us to sleep on, where there's a kitchen, where there's even a fridge that many of these people lack in their countries, we are so grateful, right? But then we're so grateful that sometimes we don't say anything and the companies take advantage of that. I thought maybe I could, just by drawing a simple portrait on these produce boxes, I can create that connections, or maybe think about those disconnections that exist between our societies and the people who work in the fields. The conversations during my critiques were more about technicality. Nobody was really talking about the farm workers. At one point, I was frustrated and stopped painting, and I went back to what I used to do when I was working in the fields, which was painting and sketching on cardboard. I drew a banana man on this banana box, and that's when I would introduce my experiences of me working in the fields, which were maybe not the same, but similar to this person who was in this box. I've had a few exhibitions where the audience is the farm workers themselves. I'm just happy to see the positive response, like the smiles on their faces being included, no? That's something that makes me happy and that makes me want to continue to do art. I don't feel the art if I don't speak for the community. It's not only about me now, it's about the community. My name is Narciso Martinez, and this is my brief but spectacular take on painting the people who feed America.
And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief.
And later this evening on PBS, an all-star concert celebrating the songwriting duo of Elton John and Bernie Taupin. Last month, the two were awarded the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song in a ceremony that featured Billy Porter, Annie Lennox, Brandi Carlile, Garth Brooks, and of course, Elton John himself.
You can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind, hope you don't mind that I put you down in words. How wonderful life is. Well, you're in the world.
And you can watch the entire show tonight at 8 o'clock on your local PBS station. Check your local listings.
And there is a lot more online, including a look at recent polling on how Americans are reducing their plastic waste and why individual efforts have their limitations. That's at pbs.org/newshour.
And join us again back here tomorrow night for a look at reconciliation and rebuilding in Rwanda after the genocide that killed more than 1 million people 30 years ago. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for joining us and have a good evening.